Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Support for WPR comes from The Alliance, a not-for-profit cooperative committed to helping employers self-fund by providing data and insights to manage their health plans. Info is at the-alliance.org.
I had made it home with my siblings, and we are at the door to our apartment building, and a shootout broke out. And it was quite an intense moment. I'm the oldest sibling, and I had all this responsibility for my younger siblings, but in the midst of, you know, the gunshots, I just froze. And luckily, we were all safe. And after the sort of shots had died down, we made it into our apartment building. We made it up to our apartment. And my younger sister was telling my mother what happened. And as she described what happened, she described the fact that I had just frozen standing up right there in that moment. And my mom said, you know, you can't ever afford to do that. If a situation like that ever happens, you know, you have to get on the floor right away and ensure that you don't get shot. A little while later, a couple weeks later, I believe, you know, I was in school. And I vividly remember this moment. I can smell the classroom, like the old wood in the classroom. I can see the teacher at the front of the class, and he's teaching a math lesson, and it wasn't the most engaging lesson, and the class is like sort of like half there and half not. As we're sitting there, and as he's teaching his lesson, and all you hear is him talking and the scratches of chalk against the blackboard, I hear this loud boom in the hallway. And, you know, almost immediately, I jumped under my desk to the floor and sort of cowered under there. And I quickly realized that, no, this was not the gunshot experience, right? And it happened to have been just a door that shut in the hallway. My teacher then walked towards me to my desk and sort of reprimanded me. I look back up. My friends are all laughing. And in that moment, I probably wanted to tell him, it's because I was scared. I went through something a couple of weeks back, but there was no space to do that. And as he sort of yelled at me and punished me and sent me to the principal's office, I sort of smirked and walked up and sort of walked out of the classroom. And none of us were the wiser.
This is Chris Emden, and this is not just his story he's telling. There are thousands of kids like Chris in urban schools all over America. And the thing to notice is that there are two kinds of trauma in this story. The first is experiencing a gunfight right outside your front door. And the second, maybe the bigger one, is feeling invisible because your experience is unrecognized in the place you spend 8 hours a day, the classroom.
It's really the deeper soul wound when you're in a place where you can't be yourself. You can't speak certain ways. You can't act certain ways. You can't talk about certain things. And so when your whole being is policed, you know, your physical being is policed, your soul is policed, your culture is policed, you sort of have to second guess everything. And so you don't have the opportunity to be free enough to learn.
Chris Emden has dedicated his life to giving inner city kids that freedom. At Columbia University, he teaches teachers, and you can get a sense of his lesson plan in his book called For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. Lesson number one, hip-hop.
You see, we're talking about young people who traditionally underperform in schools, who are not engaged in the teaching and learning process, who are sort of least likely to answer questions or ask questions. They enter into schools where they are very, very passive. And schools oftentimes work towards getting them to be more engaged and sometimes say, I don't understand why these young people aren't engaged or why they aren't motivated or why they're so apathetic once they're in school. But the reality is that the same people who are apathetic and disengaged in school, outside of school, engage in a number of practices where they express the type of brilliance that schools claim that they want. So if I go into a hip-hop cipher, for example, there is engagement, there is laughter, there is joy, there is celebration, there is a memorization of information rather quickly, there is the opportunity to be able to sort of work together with someone else to show them that they care and that they're valued. And so what we sometimes demonize young people for lacking in school actually becomes expressed in spaces outside of school. And so the argument becomes, rather than demonize young people for not expressing those forms of brilliance in school, how can we transform the culture of school to allow the forms of brilliance that exist outside of school to be welcome in the classroom? You know, it requires a shift in how teachers teach. You know, maybe your class is not supposed to be completely quiet. You know, maybe a young person doesn't have to walk in the hallway with their shoulder against the wall like I saw in a school last week. You know, maybe the metal detectors at the door and the bars on the window make them feel as though you think of them as criminals, and because you think of them as such, they enact behaviors that align to that kind of behavior. And so how do we create new models to allow the brilliance that is expressed outside of school to be expressed in school so we can then connect that to content?
Well, you've been working. Your work is about finding new ways, really a whole new way of teaching, and changing the culture of the classroom and the relationships that can exist between teachers and students. But one way, really specifically, that you've pioneered is bringing hip-hop into classrooms. So let's talk a little bit about that just as a kind of case in point. You've got a lot of experience teaching science using hip-hop, for instance. How does that work?
You know, it works rather magically, actually, right? You know, what we simply do is, or what I've done in my Science Genius project, for example, is walk into schools and sort of ask young people if they'd be willing to showcase what they've learned in class through hip-hop. And believe it or not, the initial response is, no, this is not what hip-hop is about. Hip-hop is about money, and it's about cash, and it's about this, and it's about that. It's not supposed to be about science. How could you expect us to use hip-hop to connect to science? And then I always say, oh, so that means you're not really that great of a hip-hop artist, because if you were, you'd be able to rap about anything. And I think that that kind of competition and that charge is part and parcel of hip-hop.
You also brought GZA from Wu-Tang Clan.
Well, you know, that helps a little bit, right? Bringing in GZA from Wu-Tang helps a little bit, and bringing Kendrick Lamar to a classroom does not hurt. But beyond that, you know, just challenging them. And once you lay down that gauntlet and say, I challenge you to be able to sort of express your brilliance through this cultural artifact, young people do it. So in Science Genius, you know, we have young people across the country right now who write raps about science content. It can't be superficial. It has to be scientifically rigorous. You have to have, you know, true facts in it. It has to really connect to the content matter.
So they can't just drop in, they can't just drop in some rhymes with some science words.
Right. You know, DNA, we're here to play, won't work, you know? It has to be nuanced. It has to be complex. And a lot of people think that when you talk about hip hop or you talk about culture, it means that we're lowering expectations. Absolutely not. The expectations are the same, if not higher. You know, because we are using something that people are going to perceive as anti-academic, we are more focused on ensuring that the content is rigorous and it's rigid. But you could be rigorous and still fun. You know, rigor is not rigor mortis. A good classroom doesn't have to bore young people to death. And so they rap about the science content, and they're brilliant. And then we ask them to compete with each other. So a young person in Brooklyn will compete with a young person in the Bronx or in Toronto or in Calgary, Canada, you know, using hip hop around science content. And at the end of the day, we crown, you know, a science genius, which is a person who is a brilliant scientist, but also has, you know, swag and presence and authenticity and artistry. It's this idea of moving from STEM to STEAM, but really making sure that that A in STEAM is not just art, but it's art and culture.
Explain to me the deeper kind of revolutionary power of hip hop, because it's not just any music you're bringing in. There's something in particular about hip hop as not just a musical form, a culture, a language, and an underlying philosophy. That's what you're really bringing into the classroom, right?
Absolutely. Sometimes when I enter into spaces and folks, you know, folks will ask me about my book, or they'll ask me about some previous work, and then they'll say, and now show us the hip hop thing. They're asking for a performance. And while performance is part of hip hop, it's such a thin slice of the complexity and the depth of the culture. And what we bring is the full culture. So what is it about hip hop, right? That's the question, right? I think the thing about hip hop is that it's a set of artifacts like music, like b-boying or graffiti or DJing, et cetera. Like it is those things. It is those elements. But hip hop is also a set of sensibilities. It's a way of walking through the planet. It's the soundtrack to the lives of young people. There's something about the bottom of the boom that calls forth ancestors from beyond the United States. There's something about crafting words and rhyme that's not just about making them rhyme, but about making them sort of connect and speak truth. It's the way young people dress. It's the voice intonations. It's the way that there's sort of nonverbal language when two young people from the hip-hop generation, you know, walk into a room with a whole bunch of folks who are not from where they're from. They can give each other one knowing head nod, and through that head nod alone, they have had a 5-minute or 10-minute conversation. Mm-hmm. It is the beauty of the non-script that we want to capture and bring into the classroom. And I think that can be done by sort of invoking the spirit of hip-hop in the classroom. And what I mean by that is, you know, make the classroom have an instrumental and a backdrop. You know, create a space where young people can sort of write on the walls and express themselves. You know, allow the teachers to not just be the person who's leading the conversation, but who's a part of the dialogue. You know, structure the classroom like the hip-hop cipher, where you have rappers positioned in circles, speaking to each other through head nods and synchrony and with arms around each other, with a sort of camaraderie among strangers. It's like bringing those structures to the classroom allows the energy of the classroom to shift and then opens up spaces for teaching and learning to happen on a level that we just could not even capture at all through the traditional model of teaching and learning.
And the thing that you're doing that has gotten locked out of right. the educational system, and you make this really compelling and really depressing analogy to the boarding schools that Native yeah. American children were sent off to, you know, back in the 1800s to try to denativize them.
Right. I mean, I open up the book with making connections between Native American populations or indigenous populations writ large and youth of color in urban spaces. And I make the argument that we can find such strong connections, but it's really because I find that, one, if you want to understand the process of extracting culture from young people and the implications it has on their learning, we can just look at what happened in those boarding schools. You know, the Carlisle School in the mid-1800s, where we had Native American populations brought to schools, and the instruction was to extract their culture from them. You know, don't dress that way. Don't look that way. We're going to make you American. We're going to make you better. Don't look or sound or feel or taste like anywhere that you come from. And if you can do that, if you can extract out all that makes you who you are, then you've gotten an education and you're prepared to take on the world. And, you know, that happened in the 1800s. It would never happen again. We can identify the kind of trauma that the indigenous populations underwent by going through that form of schooling. The same thing is happening today. Mm. And this is my mission. You know, I lose sleep at night over this. I wrote this book over this. That we have to do something to allow educators to create spaces for young people to have their brilliance awakened, because I know it exists there. And how do I know? Because I lived it, and I saw it, and I experienced it. And we can do this differently.
Well, Chris, through your words, we can glimpse the new world, and thanks for helping build it.
Thank you for having me.
One, two, one, two. Check it, check it. World out, world out.
Chris Emden is the author of For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and The Rest of Y'all Too. He's a professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at the Columbia University Teachers College. And you can watch and hear some of those amazing science genius battles on our website. Check it out at ttbook.org.